sons. And the younger of them said to his father, 'Father, give me the share of the property that is coming to me.' And he divided his property between them. Not many days later, the younger son gathered all he had and took a journey into a far country. And there he squandered his property in reckless living. And when he had spent everything, a severe famine arose in that country, and he began to be in need. So he went and hired himself out to one of the citizens of that country, who sent him into his fields to feed pigs. And he was longing to be fed with the pods that the pigs ate, and no one gave him anything. But when he came to himself, he said, 'How many of my father's hired servants have more than enough bread? But I perish here with hunger. I will rise and go to my father, and I will say to him, "Father, I have sinned against heaven and before you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son. Treat me as one of your hired servants." And he arose and came to his father. But while he was still a long way off, his father saw him and felt compassion, and ran and embraced him and kissed him. And the son said to him, "Father, I have sinned against heaven and before you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son." But the father said to his servants, "Bring quickly the best robe and put it on him, and put a ring on his head and shoes on his feet. And bring the fatted calf and kill it, and let us eat and celebrate. For my son was dead, and he is alive again. He was lost and is found." And they began to celebrate. Now his older son was in the field, and as he came and drew near to the house, he heard music and dancing. And he called out to one of the servants and asked him what these things meant. And he said, "Your brother has come home, and your father has killed the fattened calf, because he has received him back safe and sound." But he was angry and refused to go in. His father came out and entreated him, but he answered his father, "Look, these many years I have served you, and I have never disobeyed your command. Yet you never gave me a young goat that I might celebrate with my friends. But when this son of yours came, who has devoured your property with prostitutes, you killed the fatted calf for him." And he said to him, "Son, you are always with me, and all that is mine is yours. It was fitting to celebrate and be glad, for this your brother was dead and is alive. He was lost and is found."
Over the last year, I have occasionally, in my preaching in other places, shared with others what I shared with all of you 2 weeks ago, that I have a prodigal, a son who has lost his faith. As I began to do that, I discovered that there are a lot of other people walking that same road with me, honestly, far more than I think I realized. I know that because inevitably when I would finish preaching, those people would come to me after the lesson and they would want to share their story and their grief, sometimes one or two or more. As I began to process that feedback, I was hit with three realities. First, we have a lot of grieving people among us. People grieving their prodigals. I will confess that I don't think I've thought enough about those people over the 3 decades that I've been preaching. Secondly, as I began thinking about that hurting crowd, I could not recall that I had ever addressed that crowd with a lesson that would at least offer comfort, if not some counsel and guidance for people making that journey. And third, it occurred to me that in all the teachings over the year that I had done about raising children, and I have done a lot of that, it's one of my thickest files of sermons, I am reasonably certain that with a good bit of teaching, that for that grieving crowd, I was pouring salt in the wound. I guess to some degree that is unavoidable, though it would have been nice, I think, to have balanced it with some consolation along the way. And so I'd like to try to do that tonight. Maybe to address what occurs to me now as a missing dimension in my teaching all these years. I have three objectives with this lesson tonight. First, I'd like to sensitize all of us. Maybe some of you are like me. You don't have wayward children and you really haven't given a whole lot to those who have. With our ever-changing world, and not for the better, not to be too pessimistic, I am fearful that the crowd grieving prodigals is going to grow among us, not shrink. So I think we need to think about them. Second, I hope the lesson tonight will offer some degree of comfort and consolation to parents and grandparents and brothers and sisters and family members and loved ones who are processing prodigals in your life. I will tell you that a lot of the content of the lesson tonight doesn't come from me. Several months ago, a friend of mine wrote me an email when he learned what I was going through. And so, frankly, I'm just going to steal a lot of stuff in his email and share it with you tonight, because what he shared with me helped me process my own prodigal, which is what I want us to think about tonight. And then thirdly, for those of you who don't find yourself in that position, I hope the lesson will be equipping, that it will help you help somebody else, because that is what we are supposed to do for one another as a spiritual family. We think about somebody in our church family going through a divorce, and we want to step in and help them. Or, you know, someone who has lost a mother or a father, and some of you have been that, and you want to be a source of consolation. That's one of the things we do for each other. And so, as we think about parents making this journey and going through this grief and this frustration, what are some things as a spiritual family we can do to rally around them and support them as they process their prodigal? So, four things that I'd like for us to consider together tonight as we think about that crowd of suffering folks among them. First of all, I would want to say to those processing prodigals that you are not alone. I guess we all know that. I don't think I'm saying anything new when I stand up here tonight and say there are people in this crowd who have children who've left Jesus. I guess y'all know that. I did. I don't know that I appreciated how many. I don't know that I thought a lot about that. And frankly, that really isn't a surprise. It's not the kind of information a parent delights in sharing with other people. Listen, when your guy throws the touchdown pass or your kid wins the academic award, listen, we want to put that on Facebook. But when they're sent to the principal's office, who wants to share that? That's not going to be posted on Twitter, right? When we lose our kids, who wants to talk about that? And so I suspect that there are probably more people quietly suffering than we realize. Some of you who shared with me your story 2 weeks ago, I had no idea. And when other people in other churches feel like they can come and share their story with me, I'm standing there wondering, I wonder if their church family knows what they're going through. It is not a new problem. Have you thought about that biblically? How many parents wrestled with prodigals? How old is the problem? I started thinking about that, and listen, you begin to trace the step backwards, and you get literally all the way back to the beginning, back to Adam and Eve, whose prodigal son was murderously rebellious. He killed his own brother. I think about 1 Samuel chapter 8 and verse 1, when the great judge Samuel, what a powerful Old Testament presence, a man of God, the great judge Samuel, he appoints his sons to follow in his footsteps. But as we continue on through chapter 8, what we find out is that the boys were nothing like the dad. They took bribes, they perverted justice, and I'm confident in the process broke their father's heart. You move ahead to 1 Samuel chapter 13 to the days of King David. And the Bible calls David a man after God's own heart, a spiritual giant. And yet, if you push forward with that story and you know all of David's story, you know that the end of his life is filled with profound grief and sorrow over the wicked acts of his children. How long do we want to go on with that? From a biblical perspective, we see it again and again and again. And so if tonight you are struggling with a wayward child, what I want to say to you is, you're not alone in that struggle. First, it has been a struggle among God's people since the very beginning. And listen, there are others in this church family who are sharing that struggle with you. And then I would add that there are even many disciples who don't share the struggle who do want to be a source of comfort. In Galatians 6 and verse 2, we're reminded to bear one another's burdens. And I will say to you, ladies and gentlemen, I have just been so comforted and so encouraged by the way people have responded to Heidi and I personally when they find out about our struggle. No judging, no condemnation. You know what people say? We're so sorry about what you're going through. They've offered words of consolation and encouragement. I've had people say, you know, I'm going to add your son to my prayer list. And I thought, that's a really good idea. I need to do that too. And so in the back of my prayer journal, I have a prodigal page. And when someone tells me about their kid, I said, tell me his name. He's going on my page. And I've gotten to take a few off the page too. Because like the story that was just read for us, sometimes they come back. And I've had people who have reached out to my son and tried to encourage my son. And so listen, we've got a family that is here to help us and support us. And so don't feel like you're alone in this. Don't feel like you've got to bear this burden alone as you work with your prodigal. You're not alone. The second thing that I want to say, as you try to process what's happened to your child, you need to remember that this isn't your fault. Oh boy, we touch the third rail with that one, don't we? When my friend sent me this email to encourage me, that was the very first thing he wrote down. He wrote down, this is not your fault. And then in parentheses, he wrote, whatever you just said in your mind that disagreed with my last sentence, it's still not your fault. I think this is the toughest part of processing prodigal. The blame game. What parent with a wayward child doesn't wrestle with those same questions? What did I do wrong? What was my mistake? Where did I mess up in bringing up my kid that would cause this to happen? There are assumptions behind those questions. If a parent's child stops walking with Jesus, then it must be the result of some deficiency with our work as a parent. Doesn't it just seem like those two things naturally follow together in our mind? If a child falls, what do the parents do? I've been guilty of jumping to that conclusion, and not just with myself, with others too. I've made the point before that I think this is due in part to our mishandling of Proverbs 22:6. Will you go back to that text? I know I've talked about this in lessons in the past. I won't dwell here long, but in this context, it at least needs to be revisited briefly. Proverbs 22 in verse 6. A wise man said, train up a child in the way that he should go. Even when he is old, he will not depart from it. And so the way that I think we have traditionally understood that passage is, if you train your children right, if you raise them to serve God, then when they get grown, they will keep serving God. And if that is what the verse means, then people have assumed that it also works backwards. If your child does not serve the Lord after they are grown, then it must reflect somehow back on your parenting. Two things that I would say about Proverbs 22 and verse 6. First of all, we need to spend some time thinking about the way that he should go. Proverbs 22:6, train up a child in the way that he should go. There are different ways that phrase is understood. I'm not going to get into that debate tonight, but it bears some other consideration. But for the sake of argument, let's assume that the point is raise him up to serve the Lord. We need to remember that this is a proverbial statement, and it speaks to things that generally tend to be true, but not necessarily things that are always true. If I could illustrate that, back up to Proverbs chapter 10 and look at verse 37. Verse 27. Where the wise man says, the fear of the Lord prolongs life, but the years of the wicked will be shortened. Let me ask you, is that statement generally true? Yeah. You live a bad life, it might well just cut your years short. You live a good life, it may well extend your life. Is it true every time in every single case? You can think of exceptions, can't you? So can I. That proverb is true. Why is Hugh Hefner still alive? What's that guy, like 112 years old? And you've known people, good, godly people, who died way too young. No, Proverbs speak of things that are generally true, not things that are absolutely true in every single case. And so I would say that correcting our misunderstanding about this text in all likelihood is going to do very little to comfort parents feeling the guilt, my kid failed, so I must have failed. We try to make it very simple. And rarely is it simple. When we start asking why and searching for blame and for explanations, what we must realize is that there's a lot that to be considered. And so I want to say some things about that. There's no process or sequence to the points that I want to make. I just kind of want to throw out to you some factors that have to be weighed as we try to account for wayward children. Parents certainly have to be considered. I would say, first of all, that parents absolutely make a difference in the way they bring up their children. Look at Proverbs 29 and verse 15. This is Proverbs 29 and verse 15. The wise man says, the rod and reproof give wisdom, but a child who gets his own way brings shame to his mother. There are a lot of people living in this crowd who have seen that proverb in real life, haven't you? You've been around long enough that you could watch some mom and dad who were completely indulgent, let their little kid do whatever they wanted to do, did the same thing when they were a teenager, and finally they get into adulthood and they were just not very good human beings. And you could see it. You knew when they were 6 years old and had the little monster in Bible class where things were going, right? Indulgent parents make really sad adult kids, right? And I think the wise man in Proverbs is saying what the parents did have something to do with how all that turned out. And so the scripture would go on to encourage parents. This is verse 17, Proverbs 29, verse 17. Correct your son, and he will give you comfort. He will also delight your soul. And then in Proverbs 19, in verse 18, discipline your son while there is hope, and do not desire his death. What do all these passages tell us? That what we do as parents makes a difference. And I don't want anything else that I say as we try to wrestle with this business of responsibility to negate that point. We help during these formative years to lay a solid spiritual foundation and get our kids pointed in the right direction. And listen, that goes a long way of helping kids grow up and be faithful and serve the Lord. Parents contribute to that process. Okay, so I put that on the table, right? You know that I believe that. Nothing else I say is going to change that point. We contribute to that process, and we help get our kids pointed in the right direction, in spite of the fact that nobody does this perfectly. That's the second thing I would add. You do realize that, right? Nobody does this perfectly. Oddly enough, children are born to people who have absolutely no experience raising children. You ever thought about that? At least that first one. And just like our kids blow it sometimes as they're growing up, guess what? So did I. And so did you. Nobody got this right. You talk to the people in this crowd, the moms and dads in this crowd. All their children are still faithful, grown and still serving the Lord. You talk to them, you ask them, is that because you were a perfect parent? You never messed up, not once? What do you think they're going to say? We all know better than that. Every parent has failures. Parents with prodigals wrestle with those failures, wondering which one was it? What was it that I didn't say that I should have said? Or was it that moment where I just wasn't who I ought to have been and I set a bad example? Is that where it all went wrong for my kid? We wrestle with things like that. But in reality, parents with kids serving the Lord made some of the same kinds of mistakes. In fact, while we're deep into all of that, let me just add this third complicating factor. When it comes to parenting, you do realize that parenting does not always correspond to outcome, right? That sounds so self-serving for a parent with a wayward child, doesn't it? I don't intend it to be. But we all know that it's so. Parenting does not always correspond to outcome. And so, for example, everyone in this crowd has known somebody with two or three or four kids. And from what we were able to see and observe during the time those kids were growing up, they seemed to do all the right things. And you look at two or three of those kids and you have exactly the outcome you would anticipate. They grew up with really great parents and went on to be faithful and serve the Lord and are really strong in serving the Lord. And then there was that one. Y'all know people like this, right? Who from the time he was little had a defiant spirit, and it grew as he got older. And finally, when he was up and out of the house, he was gone. He took a different path, rejected everything mom and dad said, and he plowed a different trail down the wrong road. And you look at that and wonder, what went wrong with him? You know that, right? And see, I've seen that process work completely in the reverse, too. I know some parents who, from what I know about the will of God and what I know about the way they were raising their kids, they weren't doing very much right. From what I could see, they were terrible parents. And look forward 20 years, and the outcome with their children was just about what you would expect, except they have this one who started loving Jesus and getting devoted to Jesus, and he is faithful and dedicated. I could tell you his name. I got a kid in my head. It's just like that. How does that happen? Biblically speaking, we see it. Go back to 2 Chronicles chapter 34 and tell me, please, how does Josiah wind up being one of Israel's greatest king when his father, Amon, and his grandfather, Manasseh, are arguably two of the most wicked kings Judah had? How does that happen? Do you see it? Parenting does not always correspond to outcome. And then I would add this fourthly. You will not be the only one to influence your children. Solomon warned us about that. If you go back to Proverbs chapter 1, at the very beginning of the book in verse 8, Proverbs 1 and verse 8, he said, "Hear, my son, your father's instruction, and do not forsake your mother's teaching. Indeed, they are a graceful wreath to your head and ornaments about your neck." Pause. Is he describing good parents? He would appear to be. He's describing parents who have given teaching and instruction. And from what he says in verse 9, it must have been good teaching. So here is a kid who has received good teaching from mom and dad, and yet the warning in verse 10. "My son, if sinners entice you, do not consent." You see, in spite of the fact that this kid has great parents teaching him the right things, Solomon acknowledged that he still faces a danger. He is going to hear another voice from a crowd that's trying to lure him down the wrong path. And the danger was, thus prompting the warning, the danger was he might go down that path. In spite of the fact that he had parents telling him the right thing. Do you see it? Kids hear other voices. A crowd of evil friends at school. A college professor who's very persuasive. A spouse that may pull them in a different direction. And it's not just friends. Sometimes life and circumstances can adversely affect our children. You have a young lady who's grown up dedicated and devoted to serving God, and yet she gets off in married life, and this guy that she thought would be dedicated and serve the Lord together with her, he winds up being unfaithful to her, and she goes through a bitter and ugly divorce, and it's so debilitating spiritually, she loses her faith. Have you seen that happen? When my friend wrote his email to me, the first thing he said was, "It's not your fault." The second thing he said to me was, "It's not one thing." I needed to hear that. Because parents of prodigals are always looking for the single cause. What was that one thing? And the truth is, it probably wasn't one thing. But ultimately, we will all decide how we will respond to the other voice. We will all decide how we will respond to life's adversity that come our way. In fact, I think that's the point that my friend was trying to make when he says, "It's not your fault." What he was really trying to say is that on Judgment Day, all of us stand before God to answer for our choices. And so, 2 Corinthians 5 and verse 10, if you look there in your Bible, 2 Corinthians 5 and verse 10, Paul says, "For we all must appear before the judgment seat of Christ, so that each one may be recompensed for his deeds in the body according to what he has done, whether good or bad." Do you see it there? Listen, you guys, none of you are going to be able to stand before God on Judgment Day and say, "You know, I didn't serve you because of that crowd of friends at school that pulled me in the wrong direction." None of us will be able to stand before God on Judgment Day and say, "Listen, God, I would have served you, but you know, my husband or my wife, she was such a negative influence on me and always pulling me away from you, and that's why I didn't serve you." And listen, David Banning is not going to be able to go before God on Judgment Day and say, "You know, God, it was about my mom and dad. If they had just taught me more about prayer, had more personal Bible studies with me at home, or if they'd been a better spiritual example to me, then I would have served God." Whatever my parents did or did not do for me, whatever their life was for me, good or bad, at the end of the day, it will be my choice to serve Him or not to serve. Why is it that Josiah turned out to be such a great king in spite of his wicked father and grandfather? In 2 Chronicles 34 and verse 3, we're told the answer. 2 Chronicles 34 and verse 3, "For in the eighth year of his reign, while he was still a youth, he began to seek the God of his father David." That's why he was a great king. Because he decided that he would serve the Lord. So what if I feel like I failed my wayward child? What if I look back on his upbringing and say, "I could have done some things differently. I could have emphasized some other things. I could have not had this moment of failure where I was a bad example of him." What if you look back and regret some of your parenting? What do you do about that? Own it. Go apologize. I wish I'd have been more dedicated to the Lord when you were growing up. I wish I'd set a better example. I wish I'd talked to you about some of these things I would struggle with, that you're struggling with. Own it. Apologize. But remember, at the end of the day, while parents certainly impact their children's future, brothers and sisters, we do not determine it. If in the end I am lost, it will not be because of what my parents did or not did not do. It will be because of the choice I made about the Lord. Hard thing for me is acknowledging that my son has to say that too. It's not your fault. Number three. The last thing my friend wrote to me in his email was this. He said, never give up. Can I make a confession? I hope he doesn't listen to this recording, but that offended me. I read that and thought, what do you mean? Telling me never to give up. This is my son. I would never give up the fight to win him back. But that was more than a year ago. At the start of this journey, we just hadn't been very far down this road. And after a year or so, I can tell you that I've learned why he said that, and I can tell you how much I needed it. Because the road ahead was fraught with disappointments and profound frustrations, and frankly, there have been moments where it just felt like all this recovery effort was for naught, we're getting nowhere, and I'm done. You feel that? And so I want to say a few things about not giving up. First of all, when I say don't give up, that does not mean that we constantly force the issue. So if you've got a wayward child, you need to get real familiar with this text over in Colossians 4. Will you look there with me? Colossians 4. In fact, all of us, as we think about processing wayward people, need to take a look at Colossians 4 and verse 2. Let's start there. Colossians 4, 2. Devote yourself to prayer, keeping alert in it with an attitude of thanksgiving, praying at the same time for us as well, that God will open to us a door for the word so that we may speak forth the mystery of Christ, for which I have been imprisoned, that I may make it clear in the way that I ought to speak. Conduct yourself with wisdom toward outsiders, making the most of the opportunity. Let your speech always be with grace, as though seasoned with salt, so that you will know how you should respond to each person. Now, I will tell you that I have cited this passage a lot in teaching about evangelism and how we go out and reach lost people. Well, there's a lot of great information in here about reaching lost people. It took me a while, because I'm a little slow, to realize that my prodigal is a lost person that needs to be rescued. And the wisdom shared here can help us with that. Notice he says in verse 5, conduct yourself with wisdom toward outsiders. And so as we wrestle with our wayward kids, we gotta act with wisdom. Now, I will tell you, when I teach people about evangelism, I remind them that being wise means knowing when to say something and when it's better not to say anything. When I've taught about evangelism, I've said to people many, many times, listen, if your friend's heart isn't open and receptive, don't force a square peg in a round hole. You're just hurting future opportunities. Sometimes when it comes to evangelism, when we're working with a friend that's not open, we just got to back off and leave it alone for a while. It's hard to do when it's your kid. Can I tell you what my impulse is? To get in a room across the table, and if we have to talk all night long, we're going to figure all this out, and we're going to be done today. So to say to me, back off and don't say anything, hey, just say, cut off your right arm. It'd be a little easier. If you've got a prodigal, that's what you need to do sometimes. Sometimes it's better not to say anything because their hearts aren't ready and they're not open to it. And if we keep pushing and keep forcing, it isn't wise. It's robbing us of future opportunities. Now, when I say sometimes we need to not say anything, I'm not saying that we shouldn't refrain from doing anything, because if you pay attention to these verses, there is a lot of stuff to do when we're not saying anything. Do you see it here? He talks in verse 2 about being devoted to prayer, and then in verse 3 he tells us what to pray for, that God will open to us a door for the word. So even if your kid's not open to talking, he can't keep you from praying all the time and asking God for stuff, like, give me exactly the opportunity that I need to talk to them. And then he talks a lot in here, verse 6, about letting your speech always be with grace, as though seasoned with salt. Verse 5, making the most of the opportunity. All that's great stuff in dealing with lost people and with dealing with prodigal children. So when we're not saying anything, we're praying to God for open doors and for wisdom to handle these opportunities well. And I tell you what else, we're giving some thought to. What exactly does this kid need, and what would be the right way to approach him? Listen, nobody on earth knows your kid better than you do. So what's the right angle to get in the door with him? And how should I say things? Hey, we need to pause and think before we just speak and react. Trust me. I know how hard it is not to push the issue. There isn't a day that goes by that I want to call my son and say, are you getting any better at figuring this out? You've got to be wise. Let God open the door. We need to figure out how to make the most of the opportunity when it comes. And remember, as long as they're still here and we're still here and the Lord hasn't come, there's still an opportunity to win them back. So don't ever give up. But we will need to be willing to go on without them. And that is the hardest thing for me to say. So hard that I just wanted to leave it off tonight. Almost 6 o'clock anyway, I just could have stopped. When our kids were born, we had a single objective that we rehearsed with them again and again. We really don't care how life turns out for you, other than at the end you go to heaven. And we said that to them. And it was our focus as parents. And it is still our focus as a parent. But now that our children are grown and one has made a different choice, we've had to accept the reality that though that is what we want, our kids may choose not to go. I promise you that in life you're going to experience that with somebody, if not your kids, maybe some other family member. And if not somebody that close to you, I promise you, you hang around God's people long enough, and somebody in the church family that is walking with you, everybody heading in the same direction, somebody is going to take another path. And when it happens, we do everything we can to win them back, even the hard things like pulling back from those relationships. If it comes to that, we will do everything that we can to recover them. But in the end, if they never choose to come back to the path, I have to go on. I cannot allow what happens to other people, not fellow disciples, not my family, not my children, not even my spouse, to deter me from the goal. I promise you, if you live long enough, going to have to deal with the moment where the journey has to be continued without somebody you love and care about. And that is exactly what we have to do. We've got to go on. I have to stay on the path because there just isn't anything more important than being found in Him in the end. And it might be in this audience tonight that there is someone who is just one step away. Dan and I were talking about this song before the lesson. I think I mentioned this a few weeks ago. Somebody else led it. This is the most tragic of invitation songs to me. To think that in the end, someone would miss heaven because of one step. So if things are not right between you and the Lord tonight, whether you need to obey the gospel for the first time, or if you've done that and you're a prodigal, you're not on the path. It may be that nobody even knows that, but you know it. There is nothing more important than being found in Him in the end. So this song is sung to encourage you to take that step, the one you need to take to be right with Him. If you need to do that, make your way to the front right now while we stand, while we sing.